So now we need a terrible joke to start the show with.
Crap, I'm out of terrible jokes.
We already did the you're out of terrible jokes, and we can't do, like, how are you out of terrible jokes as the episode starting joke again. Although I guess we could use this meta commentary on how we've even run out of meta jokes, but that seems really forced to me.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I have five jokes. I just tell the same five jokes over and over again.
You literally said that the last time we made this joke as well.
And it's still true. Yeah, so my audio was messed up. I had an issue with my recording setup, and we didn't notice for 2 weeks. So this is the second time we're doing episode 12, and then next week will be the second time we're doing episode 13. So sorry about that.
This means that we have both caught up. We are no longer time traveling on our episodes for folks at home, and that we'll be back to our regularly scheduled program probably after a few days of blip, I know. So please bear with us that this episode is late. We will be back to a weekly cadence from 12 onwards.
Yeah.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Sam.
What have you been up to this week?
Trying to debug a memory issue that that can only be reproduced in production.
Right. And so, Sean, tell me about this memory issue that you've been encountering this week.
That we definitely haven't talked about before for 2 weeks in episodes that got destroyed.
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically, we saw an issue with crates.io when we upgraded to Rust 1.32. And we discovered that was because the default allocator changed with that version of Rust to be the system allocator when before it was jmalloc. And with the system allocator, we basically look like we have a giant, massive memory leak. It just rapidly starts consuming memory until we run out of memory. And then one of the things that we didn't know until now, because I've never tried running out of memory in production before, but we can just run out of memory and it's fine. We swap and it impacts our response times a little bit, but really it just makes them less steady is the only real impact it has. So that was one cool thing we learned was that, you know, we don't go down if we run out of memory. But anyway, so I figured, all right, well, so system allocator bad, jmalloc, let's go back to that.
Sure. And I guess just so that we're explaining for the folks at home, basically in any program on your computer, your operating system comes with a implementation of malloc that will give and release pages of memory for your programs. But
you're not probably glibc.
Right. But you're not in any way forced to use that. And there are many different memory allocation libraries in the world that exist. And they have different performance traits and characteristics. And so in Sean's case, he has a memory leak. But like in general, sometimes using jmalloc can be significantly more performant than using the system malloc. I think Sidekick, like, approximately halves total memory usage if you switch to jmalloc on Heroku. But anyway, sorry, please continue talking about your memory leak.
No, it is good to point out also that this, you know, this is a low-level thing I'm talking about, but this is something that impacts you regardless of what language you're working in.
Right.
So there's a crate you can use to add jmalloc as the default allocator for Rust. So we added that, and we saw some very different behavior. So before all this change, we saw what we'd see is we would rapidly grow to some amount of memory usage, and it was a different number every server reboot, which I've still never quite figured out why. But it'd grow pretty quickly to that, and then it would just stay there very steadily until the server restarts. Except for on very, very rare occasions when it would grow like an hour before the server restarted. But that was something that happened very rarely. And with the jmallocator crate, which the difference between what Rust 131 and earlier had and what this crate gives us is Rust used to have jmalloc 4, and then this crate gives us jmalloc 5.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I have a new cat. Her name is Merb, and she wants to come sit on my lap.
She wants to come play. So basically, you had the jmalloc before, but it was a previous version. So while debugging this, you switched to the jmalloc crate, but now you were using a version of jmalloc that you'd never run on crates.io before.
Correct. And what we see now is on jmalloc 5, we see memory usage grow to a similar number to what it did before pretty rapidly and stay kind of steady there, but less steady than it was before. Like, it would vary by maybe 5 megs before, now it varies by, like, 20 to 30 megs.
Uh-huh.
And then after exactly 16 hours, it spikes up to 2.25 its previous usage.
Right.
And then stays there until the server reboots.
So your process boots, and then you're, like, leaking memory and leaking memory and leaking memory to some kind of steady state. And then you stay in that steady state for several hours, and then suddenly it spikes, and then Heroku is restarting your process every 24 hours, and so you get to that 24-hour time limit, and then it reboots, and you see the same behavior all over again.
Pretty much, other than it looks like a memory leak, but we're not sure that it's a memory leak.
Sure. And I guess this is because, like, JMalloc, when you ask for memory, it's not like you ask for 3 bytes and it gives you 3 bytes. You ask for some memory and it gives you a page, right? And a page is it 4096?
It definitely does not give you a page for a 3-byte allocation.
You know what I mean.
Yes. Well, page is 4096. Yes. So JMalloc creates these buckets of various common allocation sizes. Okay. I think it has them for every power of 2 from 8 bytes to 64 bytes. And then, gotcha. And then another one for, I think, 256. And then large allocations after that. And so that's basically why JMalloc tends to be more performant, is it tends to fragment memory less because, you know, going off of the generational theory of memory allocation, objects tend to die young. If you have a lot of small allocations and you're freeing them, you end up with a higher degree of fragmentation. JMalloc both is better at reusing memory and producing less fragmentation, but it very rarely gives you the exact size that you asked for. It gives you rounded up to the next power of 2.
Right. And so where you see that steady state, your buckets have likely expanded, and then, like, things are being allocated and freed, right?
Maybe. The thing is, and this is something that I still haven't solved, and at this point I'm probably going to have to figure out the answer to this, like, to solve this issue. I've never figured out, our memory usage is higher than is reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Even with the most recent stuff I've been trying, which lowered our overall memory usage pretty decently, we're still using 130 megs of RAM. Like, we're not doing anything that justifies that.
And so I know the last time we spoke about this, your crates.io was built on top of a, like, C++ web server. Have you now completed switching that out to a Rust web server? Because I know you were doing that.
Yeah, well, so some context for folks, since none of that recording
of that
actually
conversation
went out.
Made it, yeah.
Basically, I had ruled out everything I could possibly think of that didn't involve, like, just a nightmarish amount of profiling. I was at a point where to do any more debugging, it would require a high amount of effort and a high amount of time. So I figured my working theory was that the only thing that could be allocating this much memory would be our web server. Because my theory for why the system allocator looked like a memory leak and JMalloc didn't was that it didn't even necessarily have to be a memory leak, but a memory leak would make it more likely. But basically that we had a memory leak of very, very, very tiny allocations, small enough that, you know, JMalloc can just hide it for 24 hours. But then the web server had some buffer that it was using that it was growing over time. And every time it reallocated this, it needed a larger allocation. So the fragmentation caused by these leaked tiny little allocations meant that none of the space it used for its buffer previously could get reused. And that's why we saw the growth. That was my working theory at the time. And even if that theory proved to be wrong, I knew for sure that this was coming from one of our C dependencies.
Right.
And our web server just made the most sense. So I was at a point where I was going to stop digging into it. Putting JMalloc 5 got us to a state where I wasn't actively worried that the service was going to go down. So I put that in production and wrote an essay of, like, here's everything I know so far. I am not going to look into this any further until we've tried removing the C++ web server, because I think that's where the issue is. And yeah, it is easier to swap out the web server than for me to continue digging further. So anyway, to answer your question, yes, we did do that swap out. The swap out is not currently in production because it caused our response times and CPU load to triple.
Oh, fun.
I am going to try just deploying it again because I think we might have just had bad luck with noisy neighbors.
Yeah. Do you have the ability to deploy something like that to a small percentage of traffic? So, like, only run it against 5% of traffic?
We have 2 servers.
Sure.
So, like, at best, we would run it on 50% of traffic, but no.
Gotcha.
We, you know, we go to staging, and if it's something that is obviously high risk, like switching our web server, I will make sure that when it gets deployed, I'm around to look at everything right. afterwards.
Right.
But anyway, importantly, it did not fix the memory issue.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So then we started going into, all right, I need to start debugging this more. So one of the things that JMalloc is actually very good for, and that a lot of folks use it for, even if they don't ever put it in production, is debugging memory issues, because it has mm-hmm. some great profiling tools. Problem is, until like 2 weeks ago, I didn't know how to use any of them. It took me a little longer than I'm willing to admit to, first of all, realize that the profiling stuff isn't implemented on Mac, and it just silently does nothing if you ask it to profile stuff on Mac. So I figured, all right.
Oh, I actually have a little pro tip for you there. Anytime I've had issues with like a low level thing that doesn't work on a Mac, just like Docker run, like a bash shell, like a Docker run Ubuntu bash, and boom, you have a lightweight Ubuntu ready to go on your computer.
So we actually have a Docker config for Crate.io, so I just use that.
Right, sure.
I had to learn more about Docker to be able to do that, but yeah. But anyway, so I used Docker to get a quick Linux environment up and running. And so the first, yeah, so I figured, like, let me just look at, even in development, first of all, we can't reproduce this sort of memory issue on staging. So clearly, to get the huge problems that we're seeing in production, like, we need production levels of traffic.
Sure.
But I figure, you know, we should at least be seeing. One of the questions I have is just, why the heck are we using so much memory in the first place? And I feel like answering that question will probably point me to the problem. And so I figured, like, we must be able to see something that indicates what's using memory in production being mirrored in development.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, before I start dicking around with putting profiling stuff in production, which then, you know, trying to get the files out of there, which honestly I probably won't even do that. I will just SSH into the running server and like read the dumps on that server.
You can do that on Heroku?
You can.
Huh. I didn't know that you could SSH into a running Heroku process.
Yep. It is a thing that you are able to do.
Huh. TIL.
There, I have concerns about file space, basically, is why I'm hesitant to put it in production, but...
Well, they don't give you... The persistent file system in Heroku is just, like, /tmp, right? And it's, like, tmp slash in the working directory of your process, and it's, like, files in here will persist for some amount of time, right, is the guarantee.
They make no guarantees about files persisting. In practice, files persist until the server reboots.
Right. So my understanding is this file is guaranteed to still be there in the processing of the same request.
Yes, that is guaranteed. It used to be they didn't even give you write access to the file system.
Okay, that must have been a real long time ago.
Yeah, it was like when they first started.
Yeah, the very first time I ever used Heroku, they were like, any files that you write to this path are guaranteed to continue to exist for the entire lifetime of the request you are currently processing. And that was that was the sum total of the guarantee.
Right, and that is still the guarantee. In practice, the files persist until the server reboots.
Gotcha.
Anyway, and that's what I'm thinking I'll probably do is, because I am concerned about disk usage here, I'll probably have it only start profiling once memory usage rises and like have it page me when it starts profiling. But anyway, but before I do that, so this week I've just been trying to see if I can get anything useful out of development.
Uh-huh.
And the answer was kind of.
Okay.
So one of the interesting things, so I added a middleware that basically just dumps a heap profile after every request.
Sure.
And one of the things that I've learned, which does not at all mesh with what we're seeing in production, is that we don't have any per request memory leak.
Okay.
The heap usage after a request is exactly the same after every request, at least in development.
Does that continue to be true if you compile with like the same optimization flags that you compile with when you release?
So that is one thing. I did all of this on a debug build just because it's easier to. I might try doing it on a release build before I try doing anything in production.
Right.
Optimizations shouldn't matter here because we're talking about heap allocation. The optimizer doesn't do anything to memory usage.
Well, I think it's like asterisk shouldn't, right? Like
asterisk shouldn't. Malloc is a side. It has side effects. The compiler should not be ever eliding or changing allocations or freeze.
Yeah,
actually, it doesn't even matter because this is our C dependencies, which are pre-compiled for us. Like how you compile your Rust binary shouldn't affect this.
Okay. I mean, I might, if I were you, I might do a release build anyway, just to make absolute, I agree with you in principle, but it's like, shouldn't and not definitely can't, right?
Yes, you're right. But that is a good point. I did do this on a debug build. But anyway, so our allocations come from three places that I can mm-hmm. see. Let me actually find the GIF because I can only remember two of them off the top of my head. One of the cool things that JMAL can do, though, is output your heap profile as a GIF, and it shows like a graph of the call tree that led to the allocations.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so the allocations that I've been able to find come from three places.
Okay.
One is libgit2, which is one of those. So we knew it's a C dependency. I didn't actually go through like all of our dependencies and see which one have C dependencies, but I did kind of shallow search, and there were a few that seemed. So the most likely was certainly the web server. The next most likely, and the web server, if it was the web server, that's great. The web server we wanted to get rid of anyway, and it's pretty easy to do. The next most likely would be libgit2.
Not so easy.
Which, like, I guess it's actually easier soon, because I'm going to be deploying the async Git stuff that we've talked about in the past, like next week probably. And once this is in a background job, like, it doesn't actually matter how long that background job takes. It does, but the difference between subshelling and using libgit2, either way, libgit2 gets removed from the web server, at least.
And that would theoretically, if the memory leak is there, fix the problem.
Yes. Well, and that is what I thought it was. And I last night tried deploying a thing that should have removed it. I'll get to that in a second, though. So the next one, which is going to be even worse if this is the actual problem, is OpenSSL.
Yep. Rip if that's the problem. Also, actually, now that you've said it, it's most likely to be the problem. Just because, like, everyone I know who's ever had to work with the OpenSSL C library has nothing but horrifying war stories of pain and misery. I'm going to put my money there.
Well, we'll see. The last one, which is number one, interestingly, part of, but not all of, why our memory usage varies per reboot, because that part I could recreate locally, but just on a much, much smaller scale. But MIME types, which this one will be very familiar to Ruby devs.
Yay.
We have a library that has way more data than we need, that has a giant text file with all of the MIME types, and it parses that and then keeps the, you know, giant structure that it created that contains all MIME types, which is not actually a huge amount of memory. It's about 2 megs.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly not 130 megs.
Yeah, so and that's what's so confusing here is that I don't see any. The total memory usage I see at the end of a request in development is 2.3 megs, which sounds like what it should be.
You're not, and like, there's no variance in like processes or concurrency or threads between the development mode and the production mode that could account for this.
There absolutely are, but this should be at most 50x.
I mean, I was going to say at most 50x plus some like cow madness yeah, that could be the situation.
Well, there's no cow madness because they're threads.
Oh, fair. Okay.
And 50x also wouldn't make sense because, like, the MIME types memory shouldn't... none of the memory that I'm seeing in this graph should be getting duplicated per thread. But definitely, this is specifically heap allocations. The threads would, if nothing else, they each have an 8K stack.
Yeah.
That accounts for a meg.
I mean, it might be worth just, you know, running that concurrency locally as well to see if that... like, if I were you, I would go as close to production mode as I could locally to see what happens before I did anything else here, for sure.
Yeah, the only one that's really hard to do is, like, actual S3 uploads and a remote Git server, but that's ultimately, like, that's staging.
Sure.
I probably will just try running it in production mode locally to see if just anything is dramatically different. I don't anticipate it will be, but I am definitely going to do that before I start going into, like, putting this in production to debug things. At the end of the day, though, it really is just we can't reproduce the memory usage outside of production.
That is definitely very strange. That is definitely, like, an interesting problem, and I can't wait to find out what it actually is if you ever successfully find out what it is.
Yeah. Well, so most recent one, though, I found the majority of memory usage was coming from libgit2.
Yeah.
And this one was pretty easy. This A gets fixed by the async Git updates, but it was also pretty easy to like test.
Sure.
Basically, we stored a libgit2 repository object in a mutex on our sort of general app struct that contains mostly just config, and this is the one case where it contains all of our config and all of our global mutable state, the global mutable state being this repository object and the database connection pool.
Gotcha.
And libgit2 has some object caches. And now one of the important things about this is the only requests that would make sense to cause an increase in memory usage are crate uploads.
Right.
Because we have to do some processing on those crate uploads. And also that's when we interact with libgit2.
Yeah.
The times that memory usage would spike didn't necessarily correlate with a crate upload.
I mean,
so it's like the data locally was telling me it was the thing that makes the most sense, even though the data I have in production doesn't match that.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't Git like do compactions and stuff in the background? Like, I don't know enough.
I mean, keep in mind, libgit2 is not Git.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Okay. I mean, who knows?
But anyway, so it was a pretty simple fix, though. Instead of having a mutex of this repository object, I changed that to be a mutex of the path that it was checking out.
Right.
And then just, you know, created a new repository object every time we interacted with it. And when I first deployed it, I'm like, oh, man, this was it. Because our memory usage was still way too high. That was what I was saying. It was at like 120 or 130, 160 by the time it then spiked to all available memory. But, you know, that's down from like 300. And then memory usage suddenly started looking like what I expect it to. It's incredibly stable with a very specific visible spike whenever a crate is uploaded.
Uh-huh.
And because the repository object is going away at the end of it, then, you know, it goes back to what it was before after that request. I'm like, oh, man, this is it. So I left it in production overnight. And then, nope, at about 6 o'clock this morning, it grew. It was it was using 191 megs, which I don't know why it was at 191, but then over the course of 20 minutes, suddenly grew to 565 megs.
Computers.
So libgit2 was part of the problem, but it was not the thing that was causing the big problem.
Interesting. Interesting.
And this is actually now starting to make me worry that this is going to be one of those situations where there is no single culprit, and it's just a ton of tiny paper cuts. And the fact that that spike is 2.25x the previous memory usage is because of J. Malik.
Right.
But it's like a bunch of little memory leaks in a bunch of different places.
Yeah, I mean, the solution of last resort to this problem would be running Valgrind in production.
Yep, that is going to be, if JEProf doesn't give me what I need, that is the next thing I'm going to do after that. I have no idea how I'm going to do that without, like, causing major problems. But that is, yes, I agree with you, that is the last resort.
Yeah, that's, oof, if that happens, I'm sorry, because that's just never a fun time.
No. But yeah, so that was that's where I'm at, basically, is I am gonna try a handful of things before I resort to profiling production, but I don't expect that to result in anything different, so I'm expecting to spend next week profiling production.
That's super unfortunate, because you can't even do the thing we used to do at DigitalOcean, where you would be able to tack ? Stack prof on the end of any URL and get a stack prof flame graph file back for that entire request.
Right.
Because it's not a single request that is your problem. It's the ongoing execution.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, J. Malik does have the ability to do just sampling profiling and dump every so many heap allocations, which is exactly what I want.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, is what I've been doing manually is at the end of every request. Mm. It would be interesting to see mid-request where our memory usage is.
Yeah, the problem there is you need to, like, not overwhelm yourself with data, but at the same time, like, get enough that, like, resolution is always a problem with these types of tricky production problems, for sure.
Yes, that's exactly why I wanted to try doing anything locally before going into production, because I figured anything I can do locally will have a much better signal-to-noise ratio than what I can do in production.
Yeah, for sure. I might also suggest the simplest possible solution to this problem, which is just restart your processes every hour on the hour, and then, like, you never encounter this bug, and your problem is solved.
Yes, but this is also, like, I think related to other latent bugs that we've had for a long time. If nothing else, I would like to know why we're using so much RAM.
Yeah, no, that's a totally valid investigatory thing. Have you thought about running a, like, copy on your laptop in, like, production mode with everything set up, and then running a, like, sort of statistically emulating production traffic against your local copy and accelerate? Because, like, a thing I would be interested to know is it actually time that is the problem, or is it just like sheer number of operations, right? Because presumably you can dump like 100x rate of operations at your thing and see like if it was count of operations or something actually to do with time, which you would hope it wouldn't be, but you never know.
Right. No, and that's the thing. The vast majority of our traffic, about 95 to 98% of our traffic, is just cargo build, downloading all the various crates.
Right.
And then, you know, the remaining 5% is hitting the API, and then less than 0.1% is crate uploads.
Right.
And crate uploads should be the problem.
Yeah.
And that's why I haven't tried to do anything like that, is just because I don't know whether it is time-based, if it's number of requests, if all requests are problematic, or if it's only certain requests that are problematic. I don't want to, you know, basically have my laptop doing crazy stuff, because it takes 24 hours for me to try anything,
right,
basically.
Right. It could take you as few as 86 seconds if you ran 1,000 times production traffic volume.
Yes, if it is specifically like any request causes the problem and I can just hit the download endpoint for a single crate.
Yeah.
I would have to do that at 100,000 RPS to be 1,000x production traffic.
Sure. But fine. Easy. Anyway.
But yeah, it's I do want to try and actually solve it.
For like, sure. Yeah. No.
You are right that if we just reboot more frequently, we don't even actually technically have to, because like I said, we can run out of memory and it's fine. And normally we don't even run out of memory. Normally we only grow to like 450 megs.
Yeah.
Today's the first time in weeks I've seen us actually run out of memory.
Huh.
Although I did, interestingly enough, this time see us, like, our memory usage dropped after that, which I think might have been because of the not retaining the libgit2 repository. I've never seen it drop after the spike. It's not like a quick drop. It's a slow downward slope.
Interesting. Yeah. No idea. Cool.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, for sure. I'll give a quick update on RubyFumped things, because that was a bunch of really great detail. So I realized the way I had gone about like building and testing RubyFumped things was suboptimal for me, like having any kind of understanding of completion, right? So like, if you look at the repository, there are two primary test sites, right? So one is a directory called fixtures, which includes small Ruby snippets and what they should look like after they've been formatted. And then the other thing is a script which clones aspect core, and what this script used to do is randomly select 50 files out of aspect core, auto format them, and then execute the test suite. And I was like,
so this is making sure that you didn't change the semantics of any code that you formatted.
Right, exactly. Well, actually, also frankly, that the files that come out the other side are valid Ruby files, which I managed.
Okay. Being invalid Ruby would qualify as changing the semantics.
Yeah, but so like, one of the things that was really frustrating to me about this is that sometimes the script would pass and sometimes the script would fail. And I was like, right, so that means I've kind of done it, but kind of not done it. And I have no idea how much progress I'm actually making. So what I did instead is change it to format one file at a time and then run the test suite after each formatting pass. And so the idea being that like, I now have a sequential scan from beginning to end. And as I get further into like implementing the Ruby language formatting correctly, like I actually can just see more and more files successfully round tripping their way through the format. I was like, oh yeah, I should have done this from the very beginning, but it was one of those beautiful moments. I was actually on the train back from Boston, and I like was just sort of chilling out. I wasn't even with my laptop, and suddenly I had this flash of inspiration, and I was like, okay, yeah, I should build this right now. So I put down the book that I was reading and I whipped out my laptop and it like made this change. And now I feel really good about it. I guess for the folks at home, the reason I'm sort of giggling is Sean's cat is walking all over his webcam as we're trying to have this conversation.
Merb. Her name is Merb.
Merb. Sean got a new cat called Merb. Yeah, so that's really cool. Symbol arrays work now. Actually, I guess a symbol array is %W, either capital or not capital, and %I, either capital or not capital. That's the technical name for what those things are called.
Okay.
And it wasn't me who implemented them.
Sorry, can I just stop you for 1 second?
Sure.
So the thing that creates an array of string literals, not symbol literals, is called a symbol array?
Yeah.
That's terrible.
I mean, listen, if I've learned anything from trying to build a Ruby auto formatter, it's that the names in the parser are interesting and creative. Like, there's like MLHS add paren and MRHS add paren, and whilst they are both on the left-hand sides and right-hand sides of things, I have no idea what the M stands for, and I have no idea why it's add paren, because they don't appear to do anything with parentheses. Anyway, no, what actually happened is, after the podcast that I went on with Justin Sells and Noel Raffin talk about Ruby Firmed, someone named Kevin Dies sent me a pull request, and I was like, oh yeah, open source is pretty cool. Kevin has implemented a Ruby extension to the JavaScript tool Prettier, which is like really interesting. Like, it literally transforms a Ruby syntax tree into a syntax tree that Prettier can accept, and then pumps it through Prettier, and then transforms the Prettier output back into Ruby.
That seems
like an
interesting way to go about it.
I was going
to
say, it's an interesting approach. It's certainly like, he's finished and I'm not. It's easier than like directly beating your head against parse.y. I think I'm nearly done actually with RubyFimpt. As far as I can tell, the only like hard syntax construct left is HereDocs. It is my intent to get those done this coming weekend. And then I might have a 0.1. Nobody should use the 0.1 because it will do things to your Ruby files that you don't want, such as putting parentheses on require calls, because require calls are just method calls. And yep. I defaulted to no special cases, so you get parentheses on your require calls, I'm sorry. And I mean, then really the yak shaving begins.
Yeah, the figuring out which methods should get parentheses is a fun one, because that is just a giant bag of special cases.
So there's a whole general class, which is methods that are called bare on class objects, right? So if you're within a class body and you say like @ accessor, you probably don't want parentheses, right?
Right.
Or like validates presence of, you also probably don't want parentheses because...
But like define method, you do.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, God.
It's a giant bag of special cases.
Yeah. And then obviously two, you don't want parentheses, like right. two from RSpec. Yeah, so that's going to...
Or any of the assertions in Minitest. Even though I think they should have parentheses, but the general consensus seems to be they shouldn't.
I don't know if I can support special cases for Minitest. I don't know if I can do that. Although I will say the test suite for RubyFirmed is entirely Bash. There's no RSpec or Minitest in there at all, because the test suite is invoke the command and then check that the file is the same, or invoke the command and then run RSpec's own test suite. So like I didn't write any new, like there are no unit tests. You couldn't possibly write a unit test for something like this, or the unit tests are tiny Ruby files, I guess, is another way. Whatever, that's a whole rabbit hole. Yeah, but basically this, I always in my head had this idea that the 0.1 release would be when Ruby Firmed can put all of RSpec core through it and not break the test suite, because that to me is the definition of successfully being able to auto format Ruby, because RSpec has been written over so many years by so many different people that it exposes lots of edge cases in the Ruby syntax that I'd actually never seen before I went down this rabbit hole. So yeah, did you know you can splat into an array literal?
I did know that one.
Yeah, I did. I did not when I started on this adventure. And I was like, that's okay then. So yeah, progress is going well there. Open source is cool. Thank you, Kevin, for getting me unstuck on something that I was very stuck on. Yeah, it's good.
Have you seen the Swift format proposal?
No. I also don't do that much programming in Swift, but let me take a look.
No, I don't either. It's just it showed up on my radar. It's not a proposal of any specific style guide, but it is specifically a proposal of basically saying, yes, Swift should have an official style guide, and there should be a tool that is maintained as an official part of the project, which is able to format code to adhere to that style guide.
So I don't disagree with any of those statements. It's just that how do you build one of those without having a specific style guide in mind already?
The idea is, if this proposal is accepted, a follow-up proposal, because the what the style guide should be is a massive bike shit.
Right.
And so the idea being, let's say, yes, we want one, and then have the bike shed.
Yeah, so it's really interesting, actually. I think that's a that's kind of effectively what I'm doing, right? So, like, firstly, I'm just building Ruby Firmed, and the reaction that I got to that, I would say, is overwhelmingly and totally positive. And then, like, I'm known to have the worst style opinions in all of Ruby. But that's fine, because I can invite, like, I actually talked to Derek about this some in the podcast episode that just went out. Like, I want there to be an RFC process and, like, solicit community reckons on how things should look. I will say that to some degree, Justin has already done a lot of this work with Standard, because, like,
I hate that name.
I know you do, but you're somehow okay with me calling mine Ruby Fumped.
I'm also not okay with that, but you know,
the question is,
well, I think there's more of a chance of a formatting tool getting a thing that only claims to be a formatting tool getting broader adoption. I would love to see one of these things get adopted into the language itself, personally.
Yeah, so actually it's really funny. I was talking to Aaron about Ruby Fumped, and he suggested that once I've got it to a state where it, like, it works and broadly formats Ruby how people think Ruby should broadly be formatted, he would like to see it adopted into Ruby, which is cool. But, like, here's, like, the way in which I think I will answer your, if you build a Ruby auto formatter, you can't break community norms. One of the tests I intend to run once the bike shed is happening is what percentage of projects like RSpec, Rails, Bundler, open source Rails apps, if I can find any, if not, I'll author one of substance, get churned, right? Like right. How many?
Well, I mean, they're all going to have some amount of churn,
right?
Because
right.
Folks have style guides that don't even adhere to it.
But so it's like, that's a useful metric, right? If 99% of the lines in Rails get churned for anything other than, like, indentation reasons, that's probably that probably means it's not a good formatter, right?
Well, Rails is definitely going to get churned a lot for indentation reasons.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, those sorts of things, right? Like,
right.
And so...
No, when I talk about deviating from community norms, the one that bothered me was when Standard said, always use hash rockets.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, we...
Which is not Standard.
We
I know that got changed.
We came down off that hill pretty fast. Yeah. I mean, hash rockets are good, actually.
Yeah. So the thing is, right, yes, that folks came off that hill, but it wasn't because of the realization, oh, we're calling this Standard RB, we should do what is considered standard in the community. It was because hash rockets might not work for keyword arguments in Ruby 3.
I mean, it was a little of column A and a little of column B, honestly. But yes, no. I mean, I can take this many ways. I think having some guiding principles is also useful, right? So, like, git churn is like,
yes,
is a good guiding principle. I know Justin's guiding principle is he wants to type the fewest characters possible to make a correct program, which means that, for example, getting him to agree that trailing commas in hashes were a good idea, it was actually, like, a conversation. Justin is...
Wait, the whole point of a formatting tool is you don't have to care, though.
So Justin was on team... we should have no trailing commas on hashes. And it took a lot of convincing to change his mind on that one. Yeah. So anyway.
Well, yeah.
This is all to say, I will solicit community feedback before Ruby Fumped is finished. It's like the sort of thing that will never have a 2.0, right? It should never have a 2.0. I guess sort of like Ruby, short of Ruby 3 having incompatible syntax with Ruby, like, that's what why it would have a 2.0 if it had one, but, like, assuming that, right, it will never have a 2.0. And so, like, getting the 1.0 right in the first place is really important. I will say this, if people are clamoring for something that disagrees with Standard, that's certainly a higher bar in my head, because, like, we want Ruby Fumped and Standard to be compatible for all sorts of reasons. So yeah, we'll see. I'm not there yet, but I might be there soon, and I'm inviting the world's largest bike shed into my front door.
Well, hopefully this call doesn't get... The cat is just on the keyboard. We'll see if that...
Great.
There was a comment left on the Swift RFC that I'm starting to realize I actually agree with more than I expected, which is I'm in favor of pretty much any style guide that we can just agree on and can be reasonably enforced by an automatic formatting tool.
Right.
I have my own opinions. I would, like you said, git churn is for me what should be the highest priority in a style guide. But at the end of the day, as long as there's a formatting tool that just there is the way things are formatted, there's and we can stop arguing about it. We can have the tool deal with it for us,
right.
and all of the mental overhead of ever thinking about it is gone. I'm good.
Yeah, well, I guess this is philosophical point two, right? So after git churn being philosophical point one, philosophical point two is no configuration flags that affect the formatting rules. None. They will not exist. So like, I did a Twitter poll about what the maximum line width should be, and 80 characters like dominated all of the other options. And so done. 80 characters. End of discussion, right?
I think if Ruby was compiled with GoTo enabled, you should emit hard tabs instead of spaces. Relax, it's just a joke.
That's what GoFimpt does.
Oh yeah, well, right. Because Go does Go is hard tabs.
GoFimpt is hard tabs, and you can't turn that off.
Right.
Yeah. Which is why we covered that on the previous one. All right, we're running out of steam here. Should we wrap up?
Yeah, that sounds good. Before the cat ends the call prematurely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Show notes for this episode can be found at yakshave.fm/12.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any of our other episodes, you can tweet us at @_yakshave, email us at hosts@yakshave.fm, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to The Yak Shave, and we'll see you next time.
So, framework authors, I'm running out of names that work for animals. Please, if you are considering making a web framework, please consider a name that would work as a name for a pet. Thank you.